You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 5th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sarah Milov, assistant professor of history at University of Virginia, on the cigarette, a political history. Also on the program today, the CDC report leaked. Social relaxing will bring 3,000 deaths a day. That's what we settled on, folks. And oddly, the American people oppose reopening. Meanwhile, bailout oversight nearly non-existent. The Senate, however, has confirmed Ratcliffe as director of national intelligence, and incidentally, he follows a lot of QAnon Twitter accounts. Democrats have stalled as Mitch McConnell in overdrive to fill every possible judiciary post he can, even if it means driving some old Republicans off the court. Some decent news. In the Senate, Bullock leads in Montana's race. Jody Ernst's lead completely evaporates in Iowa. And head of NBC programming Andy Lack out as the New York Attorney General is looking at some civil action dealing with some Me Too issues at NBC News. Meanwhile, National Rifle Association implements layoffs, so silver linings, ladies and gentlemen. And the Senate will not release any info on any allegation involving Biden or anyone else for about another 40 years. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I could have also headlined the failed, I don't know, what appears to be a failed like Bay of Pigs, but not with any Venezuelans attempt to get rid of Maduro. I don't know. It really reeks to me of a story, and we'll talk about it a little bit later maybe, of some dude at Mar-a-Lago saying to Donald Trump, like, hey, you know, I can get rid of Maduro if you want. And him just going like, yes, please. And some crank sending down his mercenaries down there and then running out of money, apparently, to fund the thing. Sounds like a lot of fun happening down there. We'll get into the CDC report. We mentioned it yesterday, this draft. But it is quite clear that the administration has decided that 2,900 deaths a day in the United States is acceptable in terms of reopening. Now, to be clear here, you know, look, nobody knows for sure how this is going to go. The model that everybody was relying on from Washington State obviously was about as wrong as you could get at this point. They've now doubled their estimation of where this will end. That's wrong. The virus has not changed. I mean, there is some reports actually that there may be two strains and the more contagious, possibly more lethal, but certainly more contagious strain sort of appeared simultaneously in February and has now taken over, particularly on the East Coast. Nevertheless, the virus, in terms of its capacity to kill and infect, has not changed. What we're probably looking at is some type of relaxing. Cuomo is talking about some relaxing plan, but it's unclear. I think what, you know, a lot of the Northeast governors are doing is waiting for the results of Georgia and Texas and Mississippi. And when these states start to have increases in infection rates and deaths, and there's going to be a lag, right? These things are lagging indicators. So we won't know about these for 3 or 4 weeks. There was an increase in deaths the other day in Georgia and in Mississippi, but those are from infections that were probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. So we are 3 or 4 weeks out from seeing the implications of this relaxing. And it's not going to be good. But that's where we're at. Now 75,000 deaths, I think just about as of today. The only place the rate is going down is in New York. Everywhere else, it's going up. Meanwhile, this is a funny story. I meant to get to this story a couple of times over the past couple of weeks. Maybe last week, I can't remember really. But the story was that Donald Trump overheard Mike Pence say that he was going to be addressing the Air Force Academy. Some type of, they had some type of way of him addressing them for their graduation. And Trump immediately was like, well, I want to address West Point. And he was told, well, they've all gone. They're not at West Point anymore because of this pandemic. And he's like, well, tell them to come back. 1,000 students. Who knows if their family would have come, but just 1,000 students would have come back because Trump wanted to speak in front of West Point because he loves the idea that all these guys who probably beat him up when he went to military school are now having to watch him be the president. It's not the same people, but they're wearing the same uniforms. And the latest reports were that these students were getting, you know, basically some type of orientation. They were being told 60% of you will probably catch coronavirus. You just got to figure out a way of sequestering yourself when you go back home. We'll probably do that here so they don't infect your entire families. And, but apparently somebody convinced Donald Trump, you probably don't want to infect 60% of the graduating class from West Point. Might be a bad look. Really? Are you sure? And so on Sunday, Trump went on Fox News to talk about how big of a guy he is to not infect these people.
You were asked to speak at the West Point graduation. There's been some pushback on that. Tammy Duckworth, a veteran, said it would be reckless.
A Democrat.
So are you going to do it? And do you think that it's worth the risk for those families and cadets?
There's no risk. Are you ready? They wanted me to speak. I didn't want to speak. I love West Point. I grew up near my school, you know, where I went to high school was right near West Point, New York Military Academy. So it was a mini West Point, very mini. But West Point's this incredible thing, incredible place. I love it. I know it well because, you know, I spent a lot of time at West Point. They wanted me to come and speak. Then they changed the date. I believe it's June 13th. And it's my honor to speak. But I didn't want to necessarily do it. What they're doing is they're coming back a little bit early. They're going to be fully tested. They're going to be very, very spread apart. I said, I want their families to be there. You know, Mike made the commencement address. I did it last year at the Air Force Academy. Mike did it this year. There were no parents in a big stadium, and they were very spread apart, and it was fine. But they asked me to do it, and I agree. The generals asked me, would I please do it? You know, I'm the president of the United States. They wanted to have me.
I'd love to have you there.
All wanted it.
Yeah, they wanted me, but I'm so busy. Where is this guy going? He has a day every day. He's out, you know, arguing that he wants to do his press conference. So busy on June 13th. That's a busy day, June 13th. What are we doing on June 13th? It's unbelievable. The he will lie about everything. Everything. Could have said, I was looking forward to it, little disappointed. The stories were overblown. We all decided not worth the risk. End of story. But he is a pathological liar who is insane. And they have made this calculation that 3,000 deaths a day. Do the math, folks. If the deaths start happening in June, we relax now. Deaths start happening in June. By June, July, August, by mid-September, you're talking about what? 400,000 people? We'll be at 500,000 people dead in this country? Worth it. Donald Trump is going to roll the dice, folks. Could be good for the economy. We'll see. In the meantime, we're going to take a... before we do, take a break in just a moment to speak with Sarah Mylove about the about cigarettes and the political history of cigarettes. Before we do, one of today's sponsors is BetterHelp. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist. You can do it over phone. You can do it over chat. You can do it over video. A lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. It can take weeks or months before they can see you. Maybe you didn't establish a relationship with a therapist prior to the lockdown. When you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Look, very stressful time we're all living in. This is a great way to get some help during this time. And like I say, if you don't have a therapist, this is a great way to start, try out therapy, dip your toe in it. Super easy to do. Just about everybody who's in therapy now, I imagine, is doing therapy by these means, but they don't necessarily have the same type of technology that make it easy for you to do it on your iPad or do it on your phone or do it on your computer. Once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you find that it's not a good fit, which happens, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason, no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you would find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. Also, right now, a lot of online shopping going on. It is, people are finding it safe. A lot of places aren't open. You know what can make your shopping online even better? Honey. Honey is a free online shopping tool that automatically finds the best promo codes and applies them to your cart. I've told you guys many times in the past, I used to sit Milo down. I'd be like, oh, you're going to buy this? Okay. She was really into Brandy Melville at one point. And I was like, you got to find coupon codes. And then at one point in the internet's history, the coupon codes became very, very difficult to find. But imagine you're shopping on one of your favorite sites, Target, Best Buy, Sephora, Macy's. I know Matt loves to buy stuff on Sephora, eBay, Etsy, whatever. When you check out, this little box drops down. All you have to do is click apply coupons. Wait a few seconds. It scans every promo code on the internet. Then you watch the prices drop. Since Honey supports over 30,000 stores online and adding more each day, you are not limited with where you can shop. Saved like $12 on a desk that we bought. I decided Mila needs a desk. No longer do her homework on the floor. We got a desk, $12. Better than a, you know how long it took me to make that $12? About 5 seconds. Very easy. Why wouldn't you do it? Not using Honey is literally passing up free money. It's free to use, installs in just a few seconds. Plus, it's backed by PayPal, so you know you can trust it. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sarah Millove, assistant professor of history, University of Virginia, on the cigarette, a political history. Be right back. Now we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get extra content every day and you get the free show free of ads. My pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of History, University of Virginia, Sarah Millove, the author of The Cigarette, A Political History. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Great to be here, Sam.
So I guess I was surprised, I just assumed that like cigarettes have been around for time immemorial. I mean, I don't know when I thought that they were there, but I didn't realize that back in like the, you know, turn of the century and the beginning of the 20th century, cigarettes, I knew the story that they weren't terribly accepted by women, but they were not very popular at that time.
Yeah, I think it would surprise a lot of people to know that around the turn of the century, the most common way of ingesting tobacco was not at all through a cigarette. I mean, tobacco use generally was not very common, but if you were going to use tobacco, you were more likely to chew it or smoke it in a pipe. And in fact, cigarettes, mechanically rolled cigarettes, were actually considered an immigrant vice, the kind of thing that juvenile delinquents with foreign-sounding names that lived in cities did, not the kind of habit for an upstanding Anglo-Saxon American.
So, I mean, at the beginning of the 20th century, like, what was the percentage of people who were smoking?
Oh,
cigarettes.
Very, very low. Under 1% smoking a cigarette. Really, it's not until the late 1920s and 1930s that smoking a cigarette becomes the most common way to use tobacco. And in fact, through the 1920s, a handful of states actually banned the sale of cigarettes, in part through a kind of temperance movement that paralleled alcohol prohibition.
Okay. And so, so tell us what changes at that point? I mean, part of it is World War One, right?
Yeah. So the association between cigarette smoking and the military goes back to World War One, and the First World War actually kind of domesticates the cigarette and makes it safe, so to speak, for essentially for white people. During the First World War, cigarettes are included as rations, and organizations, middle-class uplift organizations like the YMCA and the Red Cross, which just a few years earlier had decried the use of cigarette essentially as a vice, begin to promote cigarettes for the boys at the front. And the thinking there was essentially that, hey, during the exigency of war, during the hothouse of war, cigarette smoking is a lot safer than what these guys could be getting up to on the front. Okay. It's a more acceptable vice, particularly during a time of stress.
And so, and then presumably you have now built a machine that pumps out these cigarettes that is, you know, scalable in some way, right?
Yeah, though, you know what, the mechanical story actually predates this. Like there were mechanical cigarette rolling machines in the late 19th century. You know, they were rickety at first, and in fact, humans were better at rolling cigarettes than machines were. So the story isn't really dependent upon technology. It's really a story about government regulation and government support. When the military decides, in the words of one general, that tobacco as much as bullets are necessary for the boys at the front, that's really the origin story of the mainstreaming of the cigarette in America.
Well, I mean, I guess that's what I meant. Not the technological, but the sort of like the machine in terms of the production capacity. Because the war can end at one point, but the production company for these cigarettes remains. And I imagine it's scalable at that point. And that's where the government starts to sort of step in and, as it always does, picks winners and losers. And in this instance, tobacco became a winner.
Yeah. And in fact, in the early 20th century, there had been a kind of tentative attempt to trust bust. In 1911, the American Tobacco Company is broken up on the very same day as the Standard Oil Trust. But what happens after that trust is busted is essentially an illegal monopoly that becomes a legal oligopoly. You have the successor companies to the American Tobacco Company that operate essentially with impunity and under not very competitive conditions, but the Department of Justice doesn't really take another look, after that 1911 moment.
So, let's talk about how the government then, I guess, it really starts to pick up in the New Deal, where tobacco becomes a means in which to provide farm support and really basically help the Depression.
Yeah, so I think that when people think about the cigarette in America, they're usually thinking about the big tobacco companies, you know, Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, American Tobacco. But if you look across the 20th century, what you find is that the government's commitment lies also with producers and wanting to shore up the agricultural economy beginning in the 1930s. So in order to stabilize the economy, as many of your listeners, you know, might know, on a grand scale, the New Deal undertook a radical restructuring of both industry and agriculture. And tobacco growers were among the first to be enlisted under a scheme to reduce output of tobacco in order to stabilize prices. And so tobacco farmers received guaranteed high prices for their tobacco, which had its intended effect of putting dollars in the pockets of farmers in the South for tobacco growers, but, you know, across the United States. But it also created a kind of permanent lobby, a stable and permanent interest group that had access to politicians.
I mean, and along those lines, you write that the tobacco farmers actually basically self-taxed on some level, imposed dues, I guess, to fund the lobbying efforts. But why did the government, what was it about tobacco per se that made it such a good candidate for this type of support?
Well, I think there's two things going on. First, there is the economic reality that during the 1930s in the South, tobacco was an important cash crop. And so in order to restart the economy or to get money in the pockets of destitute people, people engaged in tobacco production, you know, were lavished with attention. But then there's also the political reality, which is Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal coalition relied on the votes of Southern Democrats. And that meant the votes of people that represented tobacco growing districts. And so to some degree, tobacco's political favoritism, if you want to call it that, was kind of in a certain way an accident of history. Yes, the New Deal Democrats needed Southern support, but it just so happened that the longest serving chair of the House Agricultural Committee, to this day, the longest serving chair, represented an important tobacco growing district in North Carolina. And for 30 years, he saw that the tobacco growers of North Carolina and across the region were very well taken care of.
I mean, maybe this, I don't even need to make this analogy, but if there had been a bunch of people there growing, I don't know, arsenic, we would have had some type of arsenic market. I mean, it really wasn't anything about.
Yes.
It was just that it existed.
Yes, there would have been an arsenic market. Yes, I agree with that. It's not such a bad analogy in that, you know, its intended use will kill you.
All right. And so then the next big sort of expansion of the power, I guess, I mean, because this, you know, once you fund them and you start to sort of like promote these and subsidize, I guess, these farmers, their power increases, they become a lobby. The next big, and this is sort of amazing, was the Marshall Plan. And do I have this right in my notes? 1/3 of the food aid from the Marshall Plan was actually tobacco?
Right. So I think this would surprise a lot of people. So the Marshall Plan allocated over $13 billion of aid to European countries after the Second World War. And 1/3 of all of that aid were dollars that went to procure tobacco from U.S. tobacco farmers. Now, we can hear that statistic and be absolutely blown away, but it wasn't just an imposition of U.S. tobacco growers' interests upon an unwilling Europe. In every case where Europeans received essentially tobacco as food aid, those nations wanted that tobacco. And the reason was because they were eager to restart their own industry, and receiving raw U.S. tobacco to restart their own, say, cigarette monopolies was a way to employ people. But more importantly, in a period of time when, say, their Europeans didn't have much taxable income, it was a way to generate revenues for European treasuries through excise taxes. So it was a whole political economy that centered around American tobacco growers sending tobacco over to Europe that would then be produced under, say, a monopoly label for, let's say, the Spanish cigarette monopoly. And then Spaniards who bought that would be taxed on it.
And I would imagine, too, that tobacco was maybe not uniquely, but pretty closely uniquely well-suited to be transported across the Atlantic, right? I mean, go ahead.
You know, absolutely. It's not perishable in the way a potato is perishable. So it's easy to transport. There's centuries of practice transporting tobacco from the United States to Europe. And for American growers, they recognized something very early, which was in the 1940s, they had this really unique opportunity to engineer the smoking preferences of Europeans. So prior to the 1940s, Europeans didn't, outside of England, they didn't tend to prefer the taste of a U.S. style cigarette. They may have preferred Turkish tobaccos or a darker tobacco blend, which unfortunately American style cigarettes are more carcinogenic because their initial flavor is more mild, which allows one to inhale more deeply and, you know, receive more toxins essentially. But during the 1940s, tobacco growers thought, we've got this golden opportunity to make sure that that what we have is what they want. And there was a recognition that taste could be engineered, and they were in a position to engineer it.
And how much consciousness was there of tobacco's addictive qualities that this is great. We're going to give them a taste and then they're hooked forever.
Well, they did not speak in the language of addiction, but it was through the language of taste preference, that they might prefer the taste of U.S. grown tobacco. And so they wouldn't say they'll be hooked forever, but there are certainly documents that said they'll continue to enjoy the taste of our tobacco.
And
I think what's most surprising about this is that, you know, I think many people have the perception that it was U.S. Tobacco companies that began to sell cigarettes, pre-manufactured cigarettes abroad in the 1980s and 1990s as use declines in the United States, but actually U.S. tobacco farmers were already had this insight that we can use the rest of the world as our essentially surplus disposal program.
And did this also sort of like a bootstrap a local tobacco growing industries as well in these countries, or was it basically just the manufacturing of the cigarettes?
No, quite the contrary. It did not. It actually overrode what had been indigenous tobacco industries. So Greece is one example where they received American tobacco, and that was related to the decline of what had been tobacco growing regions in that country. France, by contrast, in the 1950s and 1960s, largely resisted U.S. tobacco kind of out of national pride and maintained to a greater extent their own indigenous tobacco growing regions.
And then we also did a similar thing with Food for Peace, which went down to Latin and South America.
Yeah, and U.S. tobacco growers were spectacularly successful in engineering the taste preferences of especially Korean and Japanese consumers. And in fact, there were junkets where essentially tobacco growers paid into a fund that went to fund the travel of Korean and Japanese cigarette manufacturers so that they would come to the United States. They would go to North Carolina, catch a football game at North Carolina State before going into the labs at that university and seeing the secrets of how to make a U.S.-style cigarette. Of course, the most important ingredient was U.S. tobacco.
Okay. And so that takes us up until like around, I guess, things start to happen in the mid-60s where the government, they acknowledge, did they really not know? I mean, certainly by that time, the cigarette manufacturers had an idea that this was creating lung cancer, which prior to this had not really been around. But the government sort of changes its position a little bit.
Right. So a really significant day and I'd say U.S. history overall is January 8th, 1964, which is when the Surgeon General releases a report on smoking and health. And this report was released under lock and key conditions. It was released on a Saturday because the Surgeon General did not want to upset the stock market, because what was in the report said, essentially, that smoking cigarettes caused lung cancer and cardiovascular disease. And this was at a period of time where 42% of Americans smoked and more than 50% of Americans smoked. So this really would have, under the idea of the Surgeon General, this would have really spooked the markets. And so this report comes out, but it's based on years of meetings and activity between among kind of an expert panel. And the composition of this expert panel of doctors and scientists really reflected the power of the tobacco industry in the 1960s. So it wasn't just any doctor deemed credible by the Surgeon General was invited to be on this panel. The tobacco lobby, what was called the Tobacco Institute, was given veto power over any name on the panel. And the Surgeon General saw to it that half of the panel were smokers and half of the panel were non-smokers, because he didn't want to give any perception of impropriety or favoritism to one side or the other. Now, of course, by the end of the panel's job, reviewing analyses of of the effects of smoking on the body, you know, both epidemiological studies and clinical studies. I think there's only one or two smokers left on the panel, and one of the smokers had, in fact, contracted lung cancer.
And so that has a sort of like a short-term impact on people's willingness to smoke, but then the urge returns, and then we get into sort of the era of anti-smoking activists. I mean, tell us. Let's start with is it Clara Gowen?
Clara Gowen. Yes. So, what happens with the report is basically the report says there needs to be appropriate remedial action. That's kind of the governmentese in order to address the harms of smoking. And so government agencies say, all right, we need to put a warning label on the cigarette. And so the Federal Trade Commission says, we're going to put a strong warning label that says smoking cigarettes causes death. But Congress, which is still a bastion of corporate and tobacco growing interests, this is a Democratic Congress, preempts that warning label with a very weak warning label. And so this dynamic where an agency wants to regulate more stringently, but Congress, you know, gets in front of it, I'm sure it's familiar to many of your listeners. But it also demonstrated to lawyers paying attention at the time that in order to regulate cigarettes, you'd need to find venues other than Congress in order to express the public interest. And so one lawyer that takes up this charge of trying to find a creative way to circumvent Congress through an agency is a lawyer named John Banzaff, who's only like 27 at the time. And so he writes a letter to the Federal Communications Commission, and he really seeks to exploit this rule known as the Fairness Doctrine, which said that if a broadcaster is commenting on an issue of public import, equal time needs to be given to the opposing side. And so what Banzaff does, his kind of unique insight, is to say, hey, you know what? There's tons of tobacco ads on TV, and tobacco, since the Surgeon General's report, we know is an issue of public importance. So that means that anti-tobacco advertisements need to be granted equal airtime on TV. And to the shock of everybody, not least the tobacco companies who had not really been outfoxed in an agency setting like this yet, the FCC agreed. And, beginning essentially overnight in 1968, these anti-tobacco ads start running on TV to the tune of essentially $80 million in free public health advertising each year. That was kind of the first substantial turning point in rivaling the power of the cigarette industry in Washington.
And then it starts. It moves into the home, and then into the workplace. Talk about Gowen and Donna Shimp, is it?
Yeah. So, you know, as these legal developments are happening in Washington, there's a network forming across the United States as people increasingly think of themselves and organize under the banner of a non-smoker. So I think when most people think about government regulation, they think of cigarettes. They think, okay, well, there was the Surgeon General's report. There were warning labels placed on cigarettes, and eventually Americans fell in line once people just realized that cigarettes were killing them, right? That people basically followed the science. But what I found is that there was actually a vibrant, very grassroots social movement that invited Americans to think of themselves in a new way, to think of themselves as non-smokers. And so in the early 1970s, you begin to see the first chapters of an organization called GASP. This is a real heyday of acronym organizations. And GASP stood for Group Against Smokers Pollution. And this was founded by a woman in her early 30s named Clara Gowan. In her own words, she was a housewife. And she was moved to start this organization because, you know, she basically felt that she had become essentially a doormat and a prisoner in her own home. She had two daughters, one of whom had a severe tobacco allergy that prevented the family from going out to dinner. And yet she found herself week in and week out putting out ashtrays for her smoking guests in her own home. And so her first political action essentially was to get together with her friends and say, we're going to remove ashtrays from our own home. We're going to break the rules of hostessing decorum and say smoke is not welcome in our home. And from this action between her and her girlfriends in College Park, Maryland, they started this organization called GASP. And GASP basically tried to get everyday people to realize that they were, that as non-smokers, they were being oppressed by the ubiquity of other people's tobacco smoke in public. And so essentially their goal was to make smoking socially unacceptable.
And it started to work on some level.
They were, given that it had essentially no budget, it was hugely successful. So one of the first things that Gowan and the others did after they officially formed GASP was they basically just wrote letters. They petitioned doctor's offices. They petitioned local businesses, grocery stores to voluntarily adopt smoking restrictions, to put up a sign and say, you know, please don't smoke in here. And they sent hundreds of letters. And you know what? 50 doctor's offices in town went smoke-free. So with each place that went smoke-free and that publicly proclaimed itself a smoke-free environment, the thought was non-smokers, who were always a majority of the U.S. population, even in the smoky heyday of the 1950s, the majority of Americans did not smoke, that non-smokers would begin to recognize that they were entitled to control public space, that they were entitled to smoke-free space, and that they could flip the script on public smoking and make their preferences the public default.
Let's talk a little bit about how it in the business, because I'm sort of fascinated about and I can't help but think this is also like a time where there was a real cleave for a lot of other issues amongst sort of the union movement from the left in many respects. And I'm interested in, you know, Donna Shimp interests me insofar as like the relationship. So much of this seems like it was driven by women in many respects. This is also happening at a time where, you know, women are being emancipated across the board, right? So this is, you know, I wonder like how much of this was seen in the context of women being assertive in the same way that they're being assertive in a lot of other areas of life and in business and particularly in relationship to unions. Just wonder how much of that like became a cultural thing, because I mean, I just remember, you know, when I grew up as a young person and as a young adult, smoking was still, there was still this sense of like, I can't believe that we're not allowed to smoke indoors anymore. You know, I would go to bars and you could smoke in bars and you could smoke in offices. And there was this sort of like sense of oppression, that by people who are smokers that like, we're being driven out. We have no rights. And that it got caught up in sort of like you with unions is sort of is fascinating to me.
Yeah. So what's happening at workplaces across America is very complicated regarding smoking in the 70s and 1980s. So as you mentioned, unions are caught in a really difficult position, and this is highlighted through a case I discovered that was brought by a woman named Donna Shemp in 1976. And she was a customer service representative at New Jersey Bell. She helped customers as they came in to the the workplace complaining about service issues. And basically, she was a member of a union. She was actually quite a proud member of the union. She was a union steward. She had served in leadership at her local. But she ends up suing New Jersey Bell because she has a terrible allergic reaction to tobacco smoke. She's actually wearing a gas mask inside the office that she pulls down in order to speak with people, but she doesn't take it off. So you can imagine how jarring she must have looked when he came in to speak with somebody there. And what she encountered at work, I mean, obviously her first move was not to sue the company. Her first move was to talk to her manager in the office, to talk to her own union steward and say, can we work out an arrangement where we can move desks around so that I'm not constantly exposed to tobacco smoke because I have corneal abrasions and the company doctor says I should not be in this environment. And she's ordered to stay home until the company can work out how she'll work. And she thinks, all right, this will just last a day or two as they basically rejigger the office. But days turn into weeks, turn into months. And I was thinking about this from her perspective. This must have just signaled to her the depths of antipathy with which her coworkers and her bosses held her in. So she ultimately decides to sue New Jersey Bell. And she's assisted, crucially, by an employment lawyer who had actually served in the Johnson administration at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, this really important agency that was created to enforce the Civil Rights Act at work. So she has this major assist from this kind of pivotal legal scholar who's thinking about creative solutions to civil rights issues at work. She does not find any support with her union. And ultimately, the judge rules in her favor. And the reasoning of the judge is that, well, hey, Bell, if you afford so much care and concern for the switchboards, because nobody's allowed to smoke around a switchboard, you should at least afford as much care and concern to the people that work at your offices. Now, the union was quite disappointed in this ruling because it essentially subverted the collective bargaining agreement. You see, unions had actually bargained for the right to smoke at work. And so for a judge to kind of do an end run around the agreement represented almost an existential threat in an era of, you know, deindustrialization, of plant closures, and as you mentioned, the very real cultural issues at work as more women were working in jobs formerly held by men. What ends up happening after Donna Shemp wins that case is Shemp herself begins to act as kind of a management consultant. She begins to advertise herself as a guru that could help companies move toward smoking restrictions and eventually a smoke-free workplace. And even though she had derived a lot of benefits from the union and eventually maintained a relationship with some people quite high up in the Communication Workers of America, Shemp herself relies very heavily upon management-friendly arguments. She says, you know, workers that smoke, they're bad workers. They take too many breaks. They damage equipment. They cost too much to insure. So she basically ends up making a cost-centered appeal to management that, you know, does nothing to endear her any further to the labor movement of the 1980s. But she is successful in this. Numerous workplaces adopt smoking restrictions throughout the 1980s.
I mean, and it takes like basically a chit that unions have to provide for their membership, like, you know, that is, get you a cigarette break. That's something that we can negotiate. I mean, not unlike, ironically, health insurance on some level. So with that dynamic and it's ultimately what that, I mean, that really sort of puts, a nail in the coffin. Cause it seems to me that we're, you know, I guess vaping has replaced it in some ways. And you write about these sort of preemption laws that, that the vaping has been sort of pursuing a la what the cigarette industry did, but what ultimately puts the fork in it, to the extent that we can say that the fork is in the cigarette in this country?
Well, I think basically it's the combination of these cost-centered arguments, which do move the needle at workplaces, combined with local ordinances that were pioneered by organizations like GASP, where basically localities would say you can't smoke in a theater, or you can't smoke in the public library, or you can't smoke on the sidewalk. So it's this combination that the non-smokers' rights movement figured out of mobilizing non-smokers to claim their entitlement to public space, combined with workplaces that impose restrictions that actually have the effect of creating more and more non-smokers. Because when workplaces impose these restrictions, what many were surprised and ultimately happy to see was that people stopped smoking. When it became more difficult to smoke, people stopped smoking. What this has meant, though, is that because of these cost-centered arguments, in part, those who continue to smoke are poorer, less educated, and less likely to be employed than non-smokers. So the result of this kind of patchwork, efficiency-based, cost-centered appeal for non-smokers' rights has essentially been the use of stigma to achieve the public health gain of a less smoky society.
Are there any lessons, like, relative to, I don't know, climate change? I mean, so much of this is, like, you know, like you say, market-based, right? I mean, it's just like, how can we increase the efficiency at work? But are there lessons for, you know, sort of like broader public health, I guess, initiatives?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are several lessons that I think are directly applicable today of the history of the cigarette. One is, right now, I think a lot of Americans feel like the federal government not only does not care about them, but is actually contributing to a disaster. This is very resonant with the history of the cigarette, where the federal government was largely responsible for the production, or the largesse lavished upon tobacco producers, at the expense of public health. But there's also hope in that statement, in that we know that smoking rates have fallen over the past four decades. And that's because of action by everyday citizens at the local level. So I think, you know, non-smokers' rights activists figured out that local levels of government were not just the most accessible, they were the most successful, because they were personal and could convince other people that they too could affect the shape of government and affect the shape of public space. I think another lesson of the history of the cigarette, and this is somewhat more depressing, is, you know, policy moves when middle-class white people seize the initiative. The non-smokers' rights movement was a movement of largely educated middle-class white people. And, you know, that it was not a movement for social justice, and the way that smoking persists in this society is a testament to that, but it has overall been a force for public health good.
Interesting, Interesting stuff. Sarah Mylove, assistant professor of history at University of Virginia. The book is The Cigarette, A Political History. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm.
Thank you.
All right, folks. we're going to head into the fun half in a moment. I want to remind you today is Tuesday. Matt, what's happening today on TMBS on Tuesday?
Touré Reed and I believe another guest. I don't have that right on top of me, but I think we have a couple guests in tonight. So check that out, folks.
Professor Touré Reed, where is he from? Like the University of Illinois or something like that?
I don't know where he's from, actually. But yeah, so that'll be tonight at 7. We'll have a post game after that. So look forward to that.
You can find that at patreon.com/TMBS or youtube.com/The Michael Brooks Show. Also on, did Nomi jump on?
Yeah, I'll bring her on right now.
Okay. She can tell us. Nomi's going to join us in the fun half. But I figure bring her on and let's hear what she's going to be talking about this week on her show.
Let's see. She's connecting.
Picture of Matriarch logo.
Uh-oh, wrong
her video's live. Her audio's live.
Whoops, wrong account.
There she goes.
I have to remember to sign into the right account. Hi.
Nomi.
Hi, what's up?
What's happening on your show this week?
We have a show, an excellent show. It was supposed to be a 20-minute interview with John Nichols. It turned into over an hour just because his new book is about kind of the moment that we're in right now. John Nichols from The Nation, he's been there for a long time. He's written so many books. He wrote a book about, it started off with Henry Wallace. It's really about the last 75 years of the Democratic Party. And if you recall, Henry Wallace was swapped out in the FDR administration for Truman. But we talked a lot about FDR playing with the idea of forming a third party, as well as Henry Wallace actually running in a third party, and how the establishment time and time again will crush the left, and what their strategies have been, and really what we can learn from that moment. So that's a big part of this week. We also interview Samalise Lopez, who is a congressional candidate from the South Bronx.
She's a Patriot candidate. She's great. She's
extraordinary. Yeah. And I've known her for a long time too. So I can vouch for her personally that she's just an amazing activist, and exactly what the South Bronx, the poorest district in the country, needs right now. Someone who has previously been homeless and who
she had an amazing story. Yes. An amazing story. Oh, she's great. People should tune in for that. I mean, I love John Nichols too, actually. John Nichols, one of my favorite guests we have on Ring of Fire, but I don't get him for that long. That's not easy.
We probably could have gone longer, but we both looked at the time and said, I don't know if anybody's ready for, 3 hours with John and Nomi.
I don't know. Maybe they are, but folks can check that out at Patreon. Where?
Patreon.com/The Nomi Key Show and
Patreon.com/.com.
Excuse me. Yes. I have to be very clear.
On YouTube at?
At just Nomi Key Const. That's the, we're trying to get a custom URL, but they keep messing with us and giving us like Nomi Key Const 65C.
Oh, that's a good one. That's very catchy.
It is, isn't it?
Folks can also check out The Antifada. You can find it at patreon.com/TheAntifada. And Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Literary Hangover, we just added sound alerts for last night. So you could pay, for instance, 500 bits on Twitch to hear the woman say Steven Crowder got cold feet while I'm playing video games. So I've monetized that. Very excited about that. So yeah, twitch.tv/literaryhangover. Also on TMBS, Doris Polo from Telesaur will be on alongside Dr. Touré Reed. Not alongside, in addition to.
Do we have the ability to have people put on audio clips on while we're doing our show here?
Not with the current cloud setup. If we were going through OBS, we could.
I see. Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad about that. Folks, a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we give you extra content every day, and you support the program. So that's a good thing. All right, quick break, headed to the fun half. Check out our app at majorityapp.com. You can IM the show, and you can call the show from the app as well. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this. Nomi will be joining us. You got a lot to talk about. See you in a minute.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.